Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. A full-scale invasion of the Philippines began at the height of World War II in 1941, and almost overnight, an underground guerrilla resistance organized to push back against Japanese colonization. Filipino women were highly involved in the underground resistance, taking on roles as soldiers and conducting their own espionage missions. My guest this morning, Stacy Ann Baterina Salinas, is a history PhD student currently attending the University of California at Davis. She joins me to discuss the heroic accomplishments and obstacles of discrimination and gendered violence for Filipina guerrillas during the Pacific War, and the collective erasure of Asian women's history and contribution to the war effort. Her book is Panay Guerrillas, The Unsung Heroics of Filipina Resistance Fighters During the Pacific War, and brings light to untold stories of female resistance. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I want to start the interview with storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So you bring to light some amazing women, like Princess Urduja,
mm-hmm.
Who led her own military expeditions in the 14th century,
mm-hmm.
and Gabriela Celeng, a female military mm-hmm. general in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they? Who were they?
Oh,
what
well,
did they do?
Well, Urduja, our main accounts are basically oral histories from the indigenous peoples in that area, region of the Philippines. And then there's also accounts from Middle Eastern travelers who talk about this really there's brilliant militia woman who refused to take the hand of any man unless they could beat her in a duel. So she wouldn't marry unless they were capable.
Did she beat that man?
She beat all of them. So, and she's known to command armies and then also to travel all over this Southeast Asia and the Pacific. But she's one of the first like military leaders, female-wise, that we hear about in the Philippines. It's because a lot of the Filipino history was erased by Spanish colonizers. And when the Americans came as well, they erased a lot more of the Filipino traditional history.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we have Gabriela Silong, who is in the Ilocos region, so like the northernmost part of the Philippines, she was basically fighting for Philippine sovereignty against the Spanish and the Spanish church because she wanted the Ilocano people, the native peoples, to have control over their lands and resources again. But she was captured, and then she was executed by Spanish authorities. But they're basically these heroic figures we see in this new like Filipina feminist literature that only came about within the last 30 years.
Just out of curiosity, Gabriela, the organization, is that after?
It's a feminist power movement that came during the I want to say the 80s and 90s when they were trying to go against Marcos's regime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where is the female storytelling? Where is female empowerment? And where do we see this movement? And they named their party after her.
The Japanese occupied the Philippine mm-hmm. Islands in 1942,
mm-hmm.
Resulting in all sorts of atrocities, starvation, threat of torture, forced labor, and prisoner of war camps. How did this occupation impact Filipino women?
Well, traditionally, in the household, women have the face, women have the name, they have power over how resources are going to be manipulated and distributed. Whereas in a patriarchal society, in the Philippines, you see the men basically taking over everything on a social and public space. So for women, since the men went off to war, or a lot of them were captured or questioned by the Japanese, In this case, you would see women negotiating amongst themselves in their own communities and networks. Okay, how are we going to protect our own? How are we going to manage our own? And also the Filipino resistance movement, they thought, well, you know, because women are viewed traditionally as weaker, maybe we can use them more as spies. They'll be able to get by. They tend to have to go to the market. No one really questions as to why they have to go to the market. It's obvious to take that they have to take care of their family. So they would go to the market and trade goods that they would make at home, or whether it was you know, just foodstuffs. Yeah, so women realize, oh, we can make a difference, and we should, right? Because we're fighting for multiple fronts. We need Philippine sovereignty. We also need to take care of our home, and this is survival, and the men are away. So let's do something about it.
After much to do, the statue of the Comfort Women did
yes.
go up in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about this time period and the Japanese using Comfort Women?
Right. So for a lot of academics now, they're not comfortable with the idea of using the term Comfort Women because it has this, you know, this gendered connotation to it, because comfort is misleading
mm-hmm.
in a way, and it's removing the sexual torment behind it.
The rape.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, in the broader sense, the women who defined themselves as Comfort Women during the 90s when they came out, that was the term that they were most that they recognize. But when it came to the Comfort Women statue and how the Filipino women saw the abuse on their bodies. I personally wasn't able to talk to some of the survivors, but I was able to talk to people who were around them, and they saw these horrors go about. And it's great, it's fantastic that we have these types of statues coming up. But then again, the Japanese government still refuses to acknowledge it. And in the Philippines, they just recently, within less than a few months, they took down their own Comfort Woman statue in Manila. So again, it adds to the erasure of this horrible experience that Asian women were confronted with.
And go deeper into what was that practice?
What was
the lived experience of these women?
So for in some cases, I think in the Philippines, there were over 100 comfort stations, but particularly a lot of young women, it can range from the ages of like 12, young girls up until adulthood, who would be either kidnapped, usually kidnapped or just taken by the Imperial Japanese Army, and they would be used to, sexually make comfortable the Japanese soldiers. So if they were going off to a battle or do a skirmish or whatnot, they would have time with these comfort women, and they could use them in any way that they wanted. And it was essentially rape at the end of the day. Some comfort stations actually had barracks. Others were basically just curtains. And some other comfort stations were basically, like, for instance, someone's house in the Philippines taken, and they use it basically almost as a brothel.
So it was interesting that you brought up like the term comfort woman being almost an oxymoron,
right?
Mm-hmm. So then what, because even as it was coming out of my mouth, I was like, this doesn't sound right. This doesn't sound right at all. So what is the terminology now?
Well, basically saying what it is, saying our truth. So it's rape victims.
Rape victims.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Total war victims.
Why their story specifically in this book about guerrillas?
Well, my research specifically at UC Davis is looking at 1930s Asian American women's activism, just in the U.S. in a broader sense. But as I was going through my research and interviewing all these women who were in their late 90s or already 100, these conversations about their experiences during the war and how there were female soldiers that kept coming up. And they would always tell me, well, these are not things we talked about since I left the Philippines. And so I thought, well, that's heartbreaking. Why isn't that something you'd want to discuss? And for them, it was hard to discuss and to look back on their memories. And then as I was getting deeper into, you know, archives or personal histories, I realized there's always someone who is connected to a female guerrilla, always. And so when we think of World War II histories, it's a hyper-masculine space. We think of, you know, taking Okinawa. One of the other authors, Sledge, he's well-known, but we don't see females active in wartime, right? And I just wanted to make sure I got those stories across, but they are so difficult to actually find because we have no archives specifically on this generation of women. And so I actually had to go through their children to discuss. And usually when I found some of these stories, it was completely by accident. Mm-hmm. So the more I thought fate was telling me, okay, let's uncover some more of this. Let's keep digging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So war is a brutal and horrific time anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But for women, what were some of the specific wartime atrocities that the guerrillas faced?
So some of these women acted on their own. They didn't necessarily have to work within another unit, sometimes just housing soldiers, housing POWs in their home or feeding them on the side of the road. That already was an act of resistance, because if the Japanese knew, or some of the Filipino who were loyal to the Japanese knew, those women most likely were taken and questioned or executed. So just simple acts of feeding soldiers. They were risking a lot. And then also some of the other ways you see these Filipino guerrillas is it was rarely seen that they would actually take the lead in military units. Like we have Colonel Ye Panlilio. That was a very rare case where she actually commanded men. And there weren't many other women who were, she would call them either sister girls or she would call them girl warriors, basically, but you wouldn't really see their faces. So just finding one woman actually on the battlefield was rare, but a lot of the women that I mentioned in this book, in my research, a lot of them were basically on their own, and they had some contact with major units, but they were basically, you know, mapping out, you know, these new attack plans. They were looking for, oh, okay, who can I talk to in the next village over, and then tell the major commander that I know. So it's usually women on, acting on their own.
So who looked out for them?
Themselves. And the because women were so involved with their community naturally, traditionally, right, as mothers, sisters, aunts, the community, the farm workers, the villages, the barrios, they would look after these women and they would house them.
If a male soldier is captured, mm-hmm. that's one particular path of mm-hmm. torture, et cetera.
Right.
If a female guerrilla is captured, what are the kinds of things that she faced?
Oh, it was rape. Usually something, there's some sort of sexual violence involved. Some of the women that I was able to find in the archives or through oral histories, they would do rather, you know, sexually demeaning things to them, like tie them up, you know, burn parts of their skin. You know, skin, you know, these areas that we usually associate with sex, and just torture them or, you know, put them into the same POW camps as the male soldiers. But then maybe if they were lucky, they would just be assigned to, okay, you clean this area rather than, oh, you sit here and starve. Sometimes they were taken care of, but then you have the other way where they'd be raped and tortured. Yeah.
The book talks at length, and you've touched on some of it in our interview so far, about mm-hmm. the whitewashing and erasure of female contributions to the war effort. Why? I mean, you would think that this would be a source of pride, right, for people.
Right. Well, from what we're seeing, when it comes to World War, popular World War II narratives, we usually associate with automatically just the American front, the European front, and this male gaze, mm-hmm. right? We don't necessarily think, because we have all these, we grow up with all these stereotypes about Asian women being meek, Asian women being submissive, that we can't imagine sometimes them taking on a gun or brandishing a sword or anything like that. So that adds, the stereotypes about Asian women, it adds to what the Pacific War might have looked like or how we should remember it. And I noticed that a lot, because when I interviewed these women, they would always tell me, oh, I didn't actually do much. It wasn't me who was contributing to the war completely. It was, you know, my male advisor, the commander in charge of me. It wasn't necessarily me. And so, again, it's this, you know, patriarchal society that kind of gets into our system thinking, oh, we're secondary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what about propaganda, right? So a lot of times you think about propaganda around women, mm-hmm. American women in particular, during mm-hmm. wartime, right? You've got Rosie the Riveter,
yeah.
right? The women with their bandanas tied mm-hmm. and they're in the factories.
Mm-hmm.
What about these Filipino women? How are they depicted in the media?
It depended on which generation we're looking at. So if we're looking specifically right in the post-war moment, we see these women, you know, being their heroes. We have some film from the liberation era from the 1940s in Manila where we see Carmen Rosales, you know, she's wearing pants, she's holding a gun, and she's basically speaking her mind. But then right after, when you get into the 1950s, like the heart of the Cold War, and we have this return to this traditional mindset as to how women should be acting in the home. And since the United States still had an influence on the Philippines, right, so that cultural mindset about women in the home is still prevalent. We see this return in 1950s cinema and just social structures where women aren't wearing the pants again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type of experience is absent. And then we hear from people who survived the war, some of the male veterans saying like, oh, that female commander, no, she actually wasn't that great. She was full of herself. So all these caricatures about women, like the worst parts about women being self-involved, being very vain, that comes up again in the post-war era. So it depends. Right after 1945, oh, yes, women fighting in the war, that's fantastic. They should be recognized. But then we get back into the Cold War, that mindset, it's gone.
I wonder the differences or the similarities between, you know, post-the war time effort, there, because of in America, because mm-hmm. women did go work in factories, mm-hmm. they did leave the home. It mm-hmm. like nudged sort of, let me be clear, white women in particular
mm-hmm.
in America,
yes.
Be really clear about that.
Yes.
Nudged the door open a bit, right,
a little
bit. Women to be able to go out and mm-hmm. start doing jobs. Did that play out in the Philippines at all in terms of challenging gender expectations, and or were they, like you were talking about, just expected to just go back home?
They were expected to go back. A lot of the women that I was able to interview told me, well, I was able to maybe finish college, but it was expected of me to, again, get married, mm-hmm. get married, maybe go to the States to have a better future for my kids and my husband. But it was basically childbearing again, going back to that situation and domesticity. Mm-hmm. A lot of the women who did immigrate to the U.S., it was there that they were able to create their own like standard of living. So they took on different trades. So the U.S. provided them that opportunity while also managing house and home. But again, when I asked them, what did you see yourself as your career? How did you define it? And then they always said, oh, housewife, homemaker. Mm. Right. Even though they were taking on different trades, like being seamstresses, working for a Filipino women's club, being medical caregivers. At the end of the day, they said, no, I was a homemaker.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. I am in conversation with Stacey Ann Betterina Salinas about her new book, Panay Guerrillas, The Unsung Heroics of Filipina Resistance Fighters During the Pacific War. The book, happen, of course, I'm sure, without talking about American interference mm-hmm. in the Philippines, and we've touched on some of that already. How exactly were American forces complicit in taking advantage of the Philippines during this time?
Well, the U.S., because my grandfather also fought in World War II, he was recruited in the mountain area. So from what I know from oral histories is that if there are already some Filipino soldiers who are already recruited just to be part of the national defense, because the United States was planning by 1944, under Tidings McDuffie, I believe, they already assumed, we will grant the Philippines their sovereignty. But then again, the war in the Pacific broke out. And so within a year, when they're supposed to receive their independence by 1944, 1945 already, but the war kind of put a hold on that. Mm-hmm. And so there was already this national defense system that the United States had established under MacArthur in the Philippines. But again, it wasn't enough. And so when World War II came out like at full force, a majority of the Filipino soldiers who were recruited, they were basically taken in as POWs mm-hmm. after the Bataan Death March. And then that's when we see the guerrilla resistance coming in. Some of the American soldiers who were able to escape the Death March or were stationed elsewhere throughout, because there's over 100 islands, they were able to work together. And so some of these guerrillas aren't, some of them were soldiers, but then some of them were also basically farmhands. Some of them were teenagers. Some of them, you know, you even see the elderly coming in to try and help this new resistance that was forming. So it came from all, they came from all different walks of life, and they did traditionally always work with American soldiers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there was some infighting, right? Because there's still this idea is, are we sovereign? When this war is over, will we still be working with the United States? Is there really independence at the end of this? That was always on a lot of their minds. But at the end of the day, they decided, no, we need to work together. And so they would actually form unions with American soldiers who were able to get away from the Japanese.
And then let's talk post-war.
Mm-hmm. Post-war.
Post-war.
Right. Well, we still see the United States right after the war being heavily involved with Philippine domestic politics, right? So 1945, 1946, we see Philippines independence. But again, the Philippines is still the major entry for the United States to maintain a hold in the Pacific mm-hmm. because there's this new threat, quote unquote, communism, right? And they're worried that the Philippines might be taken over by this newfound threat. But also in actuality, they're using a lot of the Philippines to take resources from still. So not only is it a port of entry for them into the Pacific and making sure that they safeguard democracy, but also
sometimes I wish this was a television show and not a radio show so people could see people's faces, right?
Right.
I always say I'm using air quotes.
Right, no, but because it just sounds so ridiculous if we look back on it, but this isn't very far away in our history.
That's right.
Right. But again, you know, using the Philippines for multiple purposes. I mean, we don't see the closing of the naval American bases until what? The People's Power Movement in the 80s
right.
under Aquino. But again, you know, you see the Philippines being used and being, you know, puppeteered, managed by the United States in the background. And even under Marcos's reign, you know, he is best friends with Kennedy.
Right.
He's best friends with, you know, American diplomats. So you, and even today when you ask some Filipinos, like, oh, if you could go anywhere, would you want to go? They say they'd want to work in the United States because it still seems like a land of opportunity. But again, it's, you know, this type of post-colonial brainwashing that we just don't see anymore because we're so used to it.
We talked earlier about the rape victims mm-hmm. during World War II. But talk a little bit about, and I know I'm veering some off topic, but I think it's important like to bring past to present, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the U.S. military presence and the impact on sexual assault and
right.
violence and exploitation of Filipino women in our more recent history.
Right. So It is pretty rough to consider that even after two world wars, where the Philippines was an ally to the United States, that we still see, you know, this sexual violence associated with military, American military. From my other interviews with families, I found out that some of them who have ties to the military, used to work for the military, they would always see, for instance, when they would go to entertainment night or they would go to these bars that were around the naval bases, they would see Filipinas. And these Filipina women would not only, they would sing, dance, they would serve as hosts at these bars or these nightclubs, but they wouldn't just be stationed near American naval bases in the Philippines. You would see Filipina performers actually in, like, Japan, for instance, where the American soldiers would be visiting, or you would see them wherever the United States is stationed. So these Filipino workers, these hosts, these entertainers, you'd see them actually following these migration paths as to where the American military was. Mm. Mm-hmm. And some of these women would actually want and think that, oh, well, perhaps if I am able to marry an American military man, you know, I would be able to take care of my family. I would be able to take care of myself. I would be able to provide for generations to come because of my ties to the United States. And so that's where you see a lot of Filipino women still interacting with American military. It's in these, I wouldn't say underground, but they're in these nightclub scenes where they're performers, singers, serving drinks. Yeah, it's still prevalent because you still see these Filipino entertainers in Korea, for example, in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And high levels of sexual violence associated in some of these scenes, correct?
Yes, but it's not talked about because a lot of people think, well, you know, that's the name of the game. You enter into that business, of course, you're going to see these repercussions. People don't really understand that, no, there shouldn't be any types of sexual violence associated with this at all, right?
Given the current political climate in the Philippines, mm-hmm. with Duterte, mm-hmm. How important are these stories? And of these, how important is it to remember these Filipina warriors? And how are we seeing women and girls leading resistance to oppression in the Philippines today?
Yeah, that's a really sensitive topic. With Duterte, when you look at... So when we look at Philippine news and we compare it to American news, there's a lot of topics or scenes that we aren't seeing because, of course, we have people who are managing Philippine news and what's being seen. But just listening to Duterte's comments about women, it hits you in the gut and it really reminds you of...
Give some examples.
Just saying when asked, why are you taking down the Comfort Woman statue? You know, these women, how many of them are actually left to tell their story? The more you decide to take down the statue without the vote of the people of Congress, what does that say about the right to vote, the right to participate, the right to be heard? And he basically responded in Tagalog saying that, well, this history is done. It's done. It's finished now. We have other things to talk about. We need to maintain relations with Japan. How do you think the Japanese would feel if they saw a comfort statue that reminds them of the, you know, the brutality of World War II? And again, it's this conversation about, so it's okay to ignore Filipina women who were sexually violated in history, but you're willing to acknowledge nothing else about the war because you think it's over and done. Mm-hmm. And the main topic are these Filipino women, and it's highly gendered. Why not go into this conversation? And he basically just said, no, that story is done. Mm. There's no need. And then when you hear him talk about women journalists or women who speak their mind, you know, one of his other comments was saying, oh, you should shoot them in their private parts because that's where you'll get them. You know, that's where they're of most use, you know, reproductive value. But you shoot them there, good, they're useless at that point. And those were one of his comments in the past, among other things. And his homophobic, you know, remarks as well, you know, saying that he was gay, but he was able to, you know, train himself to not be. All those things are related to this understanding of gender and this, you know, this patriarchal cloud that's still kind of is present in Philippine politics. And so all of that adds to the erasure of, you know, women in war, women participating in politics, because then what voice do they have if their leader doesn't acknowledge them besides their reproductive value? That's all he sees them for.
Well, what voice do you see women asserting for themselves, regardless of Duterte, in the movements that are happening? I mean, I know even just from the Bay Area, mm-hmm. several of my Filipino comrades have moved, right? They're like, I'm going home. I'm going to go be a part of this fight.
Yes, I think some of the organizations that I'm familiar with, we have the Malaya... the Malaya movement, they advocate for, you know, removing Duterte from position of power, you know, making sure that the indigenous peoples are heard. And then I also participate with Pacific Atrocities Education, they helped me publish this book. They talk about, okay, what are the atrocities that happened in the Pacific and where are the legacies of it? You know, women's rights in the Pacific and the Philippines. It's part of this narrative as well. So they also advocate for that in the publishing that they do. And then also with the Bulosan Center of Philippinic Studies at UC Davis, which I am the head historian of. There we participate with other grassroots organizations talking about, okay, what are indigenous people's rights? What are women's rights? What is their reproductive justice in the Philippines? What is affordable housing? What is, you know, the ability to eat? How do we get education that's equal for all? And how do we do that not only in the United States but in the Philippines? That's where we see a lot of these women coming together fighting for not only indigenous women's rights but also this, you know, this broader term of feminism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we see a lot of it in grassroots. And then there are many who want to go back to the Philippines to continue this movement that's mm-hmm. coming forward. But, you know, some of us also think, well, we should also fight it here while we have the means to do it here as well. Mm-hmm. But we also maintain contact with these other groups.
What haven't I asked you that folks need to know?
Well, just get interested in history in general. Ask your grandparents, your aunts. You don't know where their narratives took them. You don't know what legacies they left behind, because a lot of these women, these grandmothers, these dear grandmothers, you know, they didn't realize just how powerful of a stand they are making. Right. Yeah. And so I think when you actually talk to elderly, you talk to your own people and you ask them about their past, you know, it makes them realize just how much change has happened and how much there's still more to do. But I think we need those narratives in order to understand our roots, where we come from, and why we still matter.
Thank you so mm-hmm. much for bringing these stories forth and for joining me yep. on the show this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. I have been in conversation with Stacey Ann Betterina Salinas, who is a history PhD student currently attending the University of California at Davis. Her new book is Panay Guerrillas, The Unsung Heroics of Filipina Resistance Fighters During the Pacific War.